From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 1-800-NOW-OPEN or open.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Who among U.S. administrations bears more blame for the escalating situation? The Bush administration or the Clinton administration?
If a nuclear device is detonated but there's no American to hear it, does it make a sound? It turns out it does, and it sounds a little something like this. Hillary Clinton?
Some of the reason we are facing this danger is because of the failed policies of the Bush administration.
John McCain?
I would remind Senator Clinton that the framework agreement her husband's administration negotiated was a failure.
And George Bush?
Bilateral negotiations didn't work. I appreciate the efforts of previous administrations. It just didn't work.
Such was the fallout this week on America's airwaves as the political class locked horns not only over the best course for the future, but also over how we got to where we are now. And with a few exceptions, the Washington Post, the LA Times, and the Baltimore Sun among them, the media have done little to clarify the picture for people who haven't been paying close attention until now. One person who has been paying attention is Dan Snyder, a Korea expert at Stanford's Shorenstein Center, who covered East Asia for the Christian Science Monitor in the 80s. He says journalists would be more useful if they behaved less like stenographers.
So when John McCain says during the Clinton administration, the North Koreans shut down the international inspection, withdrew from the NPT, started reprocessing their plutonium, it would be useful if someone would point out that actually, factually, that's simply not true. The president the other day made the statement he's made many times, direct negotiations with North Koreans do not work. I see that reported all the time, but what's the basis for saying that? What's the evidence for that? I never see that explored.
There seems to be one particularly salient fact that has been utterly absent from all the reporting, and that is, nuclear weapons or not, the North Koreans have always, at least for the last 30 years, been one lanyard pull away from sending thousands of megatons of conventional missiles to destroy Seoul in a minute's time. The basic security status quo seems to not be part of the discussion.
No, I've seen almost no discussion of that. I mean, if you look at the Chinese media and the South Korean media, you'll see that the fear of war is very, very much at the top of their minds. I mean, here's a question somewhat along the lines you raised. What's the status of U.S. forces in South Korea, for example? How prepared are we, the United States, to respond to an outbreak of war in the Korean Peninsula, given the commitments in Iraq? I haven't seen a single article discussing that. What's the sort of state of play on the demilitarized zone that separates North and South Korea? Over the weekend, just before the explosion of the nuclear device, there was an exchange of fire, South Korean troops firing on North Koreans who had crossed over the DMZ. That's the first time that's happened in a long time. It got no coverage that I'm aware of. You know, always at moments like this, we sort of get very myopic. It's all about us. And not only that, it's all about our politics. And, you know, we don't seem to think about, well, what does this actually mean to not only ourselves, but how about the people right close by, South Koreans, Japanese, Chinese?
Of course, it would be easier for U.S. news organizations to report what was happening on the ground in South Korea if we had anybody on the ground in South Korea. But yeah. Retrenchment, especially at the major networks, has really had an effect on how far flung they are in terms of foreign bureaus.
Right. There were only two major American newspapers that I know of that had bureaus in Seoul. One was the Wall Street Journal and the other the Los Angeles Times. And the LA Times just closed their bureau. So now it's down to one.
If the networks and the major newspapers were heavily invested in the Pacific Rim, what stories would we be seeing now that we simply aren't seeing at all?
I think what you would see much more of is how is this rippling out into these populations of people that sit right next door to North Korea? I still haven't seen a good story, for example, on what this has meant to South Korean public opinion. I go and read the South Korean media, and this has triggered a huge debate, a rip-roaring debate in South Korea. There's a lot of coverage that says, oh, China, how China responds is pretty crucial. Are the Chinese going to crack down on the North Koreans? Are they not? What are they doing at the UN? You get that. But again, not a whole lot of sense of how does this ripple out in China? It's pretty important for us to understand, you know, how these governments are going to react based upon the pressures that are on them from their own people.
Is there the same kind of finger-pointing going on in South Korea and being played out in the South Korea media as we're seeing here?
Yes. They're having their own blame game going on, and it's a pretty vicious one, I might say. Is it the Americans? Is it the party in power? The conservative opposition is going after the ruling party. The parliament's been in a big debate. But, you know, unlike our administration, the current administration in Korea, their first reaction was, you know, my gosh, we've been pursuing this policy of engagement with North Korea, the so-called Sunshine Policy, for 10 years over two South Korean administrations. Clearly, it's failed. And the South Korean president basically said that. This engagement policy has failed. So now they're trying to figure out, well, what do you do? I mean, do you abandon engagement or is there another way to pursue it? I see more reflection on failure in Korea and China than I do in Washington.
All right, Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Daniel Snyder is Associate Director for Research at the Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center at Stanford University.
Anna Politkovskaya was a reporter and human rights activist who was highly critical of the war in Chechnya. Last week, she was found dead in the elevator of her apartment building in central Moscow, shot in the head at close range. Hers is the latest in a string of contract killings of Russian journalists over the past decade. No one, including colleagues at her newspaper Novaya Gazeta, knows who killed her or why, but few doubt it had something to do with her work. For years, she has doggedly tracked human rights abuses by pro-Kremlin forces in the province of Chechnya. Many of her colleagues say that her death has cast a pall over independent journalism in Moscow, but Boris Kargalitsky, a writer and director of the Institute of Globalization Studies in Moscow, says that actually her death may have had the opposite effect.
Quite a lot of people started speaking aloud and discussing certain topics they didn't discuss before, so I think people started feeling a kind of shame.
When you say that they're discussing topics that they haven't discussed before, what are you talking about?
Well, let's have one example. Today, we have a terrible problem with the Georgian population in Russia, which is now becoming victimized by Russian police, including those who are Russian citizens. Before Anna's death, pro-government media paid very little attention to these actions of the authorities. And now it is reporting these things, and I think that will be a very important change because some of these practices will stop.
Do you feel that they were shamed by the mourners thronging the streets for Anna Politkovskaya?
Yes, exactly so. Because just the day after Anna Politkovskaya was killed, there was a rally to protest against discrimination of ethnic Georgians. And among those people who showed up, I've seen some professional journalists who were actually working for pro-governmental publications, and they came to join the rally.
What about the political climate in general? Politkovskaya is the 13th journalist to be killed in this way since 2000, and that's 2 years since Putin became president. You were imprisoned under Brezhnev and under Yeltsin. You haven't been imprisoned under Putin.
Fortunately, not yet.
Do you see the situation as a return to fascism, as some in your own press have said?
Well, no, I don't agree with that. Let me say, I think that Politkovskaya was not killed as a journalist, but she was killed first of all as a human rights activist who was involved in organizing human rights movement. When, as a journalist, you just keep writing, you just keep publishing articles, you can feel quite safe because nothing changes. It's absolutely contrary to the general logic of Russian politics to kill journalists because of their writings. Usually, journalists get killed in Russia because they reveal something mainly about money. You see, if you're writing that a bureaucrat named Ivan Ivanovich is stealing money, that's no problem. But when you're writing that Ivan Ivanovich has stolen money, which he had to share with Ivan Petrovich, and he didn't share that, then Ivan Ivanovich will be the person to try to kill the journalist before he publishes the article, right? So this is like a mafia thing in the United States in the 20s, and in that sense, you shouldn't say that this is politics, it is just money.
Yeah, I saw the rise of the mafia myself when I was reporting from Moscow from 1992 to 1995. But at that time, I also saw what appeared to be a flowering of independent media. There were all sorts of new magazines and newspapers and independent TV and radio stations. All that independence is gone.
Well, actually, I will not exactly agree with you because you know, when was the golden age for Russian media? There were two golden ages, which I remember myself. One was the late Soviet years, when the Soviet censorship already collapsed, and new kind of self-censorship and new mechanisms of media control were not yet established, 1989 to 92 maybe. And ironically, the first 2 years of Putin were also very good for Russian media for the very same reason, so that the old Yeltsin-style mechanism of control over the media also started eroding, and the Putin-style, more kind of traditional, more kind of heavy-handed system of control was not yet in place. The very name of Politkovsky and some other names emerged in the Russian media exactly during that period from 1999 to 2001. These were the 2 or 3 years when the media was more or less free, or at least the journalists were able to deliver their own voices to the public.
As you suggest, Anna Politkovskaya was a human rights activist, and it was because she actually was having an impact that she was killed. Did you anticipate that this would happen eventually?
Well, you know, I was afraid of her being killed in Chechnya. And I discussed it with her, and I asked her whether she was afraid of disappearing there. And I just remember she told me that, well, she was kind of more afraid, more scared of Moscow than of Chechnya. And I didn't take that very seriously, to be honest.
Boris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Boris Kargalitsky is the director of the Institute of Globalization Studies. He spoke to us from Moscow.
Coming up, Google gobbles YouTube and libel laws loosen in Britain.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Every day, 70,000 new videos are posted and 100 million videos are streamed via the vast global video repository called YouTube. Whether those videos are personal diaries, musical mashups, or bits ripped from The Daily Show, YouTube is all about harnessing the creative energies of every man for the benefit of every other man around the world. That's why many users feel a sense of ownership about YouTube. It's pure, it doesn't pitch. And that's why when Google bought it this week for $1.65 billion, it worried some of the faithful.
What happens if Google decides to just turn YouTube into something like Google Video? there goes the whole community aspect of it, and I think that'd be terrible. Who do we turn to now?
Offending the sensibilities of the YouTubosphere is but one of the many obstacles facing Google as it attempts to transform a media phenomenon into an ongoing business. Another is the basic question of who owns what in the videos that are posted there. Rashad Tabakawala is CEO of Denu, the new media consultancy. He says lawsuits over unauthorized use of copyrighted material are the next shoe to drop. Rashad, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk about this copyright infringement issue, because it continues to come up around YouTube. Not only can you find large portions of television shows and movies on YouTube, many of the personal user-generated videos have music underneath them that, you know, they simply don't have the rights to use, but there it is on YouTube anyway. How big a potential problem is that?
It's potentially a very big problem right now. Because A, obviously Google has money. YouTube did not have money. Second is, for Google to justify the $1.65 billion, they're going to have to try to start monetizing those videos. And what tends to happen is you don't sue somebody if they don't make any money. But the moment they start making money on your content, you sue them. And that's one of the reasons why you're seeing Google trying to make relationships with various copyright owners, but they need to get all the major copyright owners. Otherwise, if anyone is left out, they'll sue.
It's hard to see at first glance where exactly YouTube will put any advertising that it has on its site. It has said that the idea of running commercials before a video rolls, so-called pre-roll advertising, is absolutely out of the question. What exactly are they going to sell to advertisers?
They are going to try to figure it out. The way they think long term may have nothing to do with selling advertising in the very near future. The first thing is they have prevented YouTube from becoming a part of Microsoft, Yahoo, or anybody else. And when you have as much money as they do, it basically keeps the momentum going for them, which is they're an unstoppable force. The second is they are a company that likes iterating their way towards success. The reason that their search works so well is because more people search on them. So they have more and more ways to iterate and more cycles. Their Google Video was not a very good place because not too many people use Google Video. So they couldn't have their engineers and their software and their programmers learn how to scale and learn better about how video search works. Now, with the kind of traffic that our friends at YouTube have, they have a way to experiment. Think of this as a large R&D place for them to figure out how video search goes.
As I understand it, you don't think that they ultimately can fail. What is it about YouTube that is so promising in the end?
We are moving into a generation of people who basically like creating content as much as they like consuming content. We're living in this generation where everybody expects to be famous, and the way they become famous is by saying, here is my riff on the world. And YouTube happens to be one of the places, which is the canvas on which they paint their lives. As a marketer, eventually you are marketing to people. If this is how people spend their time, you have to align with them or you're no longer a marketer.
Rashad, you for many years have been in the media buying and media planning and the media future thinking about business. You know Madison Avenue. You know how advertisers think, and you know what a bunch of scaredy cats they are. Are they prepared for whatever this YouTube and Google deal seems to presage? Are they ready?
My sense is at the current time, most people are not ready. And so to a certain extent, they're sort of dazed and confused as to what is basically happening. 3 years ago, if you were planning things, you would not have thought about iTunes, YouTube, MySpace, Google, right? Now I said, let's start looking at 3 weeks ago. In the last 3 weeks, give or take 1 week, you basically have had the Google-YouTube relationship. You've had Freston getting thrown out.
Of Viacom.
Right. You've got Jobs talking about ITV. You've got Amazon basically talking about Unbox. And so forget about 3 years. In a month, you've got a new world. And this whole idea of planning is becoming very, very difficult. In fact, what we basically say is we now have classical structures in a jazz age.
Well, Rashad, once again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
Rishad Tabakawala is CEO of Denu, the global new media consultancy based in Chicago.
We love YouTube, but its video clips don't look so hot. They're jerky, blocky, and small because the internet connections to most American homes don't have enough power to deliver better-looking images. When it comes to the quality of internet service, the U.S. has fallen behind at least a dozen European and Asian countries where net connections are at least 10 times more powerful and can serve up full-screen, high-definition video. Rick Carr has been working on a PBS special about the future of the internet that airs on Wednesday night. He found that America's bandwidth gap and the debate over network neutrality, currently raging in Washington, aren't just about the future of the net, but of television as we know it.
In January of 1994, then-Vice President Al Gore gave a speech in Los Angeles introducing the Clinton administration's plan for the digital future. The Academy of Television Arts and Sciences co-sponsored the event. The audience included a lot of TV executives, and TV star Lily Tomlin helped Gore explain the information superhighway.
See if this is an accurate description. Is it kind of like billions and billions of tiny little bako bits of valuable information strewn in every direction across that great salad bar in cyberspace? Is that it?
That's... Close.
Does that sound more like your local Sizzler?
Gore went on to describe a plan to connect every American to a new super-fast digital network that would deliver everything from the written word to radio and TV. The dot-comers of the day called the idea convergence. All media would converge online because the net treats everything, from an email to a YouTube clip, the same as a bunch of ones and zeros. On a network like the one Gore envisioned, convergence could let us watch whatever we want, whenever we want. Producers could cut out the middlemen at networks and distribute shows directly to viewers. Just after the vice president's speech, the private sector took up the challenge.
All the phone companies said, we'll step up to the plate and we'll do this wiring plan.
That's Bruce Kushnick, a former telephone industry analyst who co-founded watchdog group Teletruth. He says the phone companies asked state legislatures to lift rate caps and give tax breaks in exchange for a new cutting-edge fiber optic network, providing connections 45 times more powerful than what most Americans have today, good enough even for power-hungry high-definition television. Kushnick says lawmakers nationwide agreed.
By the year 2006, our research shows that 86 million households should have been wired with fiber, i.e., the majority of the United States.
Phone companies promised to have 6 million customers hooked up by this year in California, for example, and 5 million in New Jersey. Kushnick's colleague Tom Alabone says in the Garden State, the number they've actually built is...
zero. I mean, nobody can get 45 megabit. It doesn't exist. The only thing that comes close is in a commercial type of environment for very specialized types of applications, but there's no such thing in a residential consumer marketplace.
Alabone and Kushnick say the states didn't hold the telephone companies to their promises to build the new fiber optic network. Instead, regulators let phone firms offer inferior broadband service over their existing copper wires, an improvement over dial-up internet connections, but not nearly powerful enough for high-quality TV. Today, the phone companies argue, that network is stretched to the limit, in part due to the popularity of websites like YouTube and internet telephone services like Vonage and Skype. Pretty soon, it won't be able to keep up, according to Mike McCurry, former press secretary in the Clinton White House and now a spokesman and lobbyist for a coalition of big telecom and technology firms. But, he says, his clients have a solution.
They, in effect, want to operate a superhighway but then build a separate premium lane next to it that they're going to charge big content providers for it, ask them to spread the costs of building some of this network out among their customers.
His clients no longer want to treat everything on the network the same. They want to be able to hold back an email message, for example, in order to speed along a video, as long as whoever's sending the video has paid McCurry's clients for the privilege. If the new network were to treat everything the same, YouTube and similar sites could offer high-quality video and eat up a lot of the network's capacity. So the phone companies say they want the right to reserve most of that capacity for their own television offerings. In other words, to get into the $100 billion a year cable TV business. customers wouldn't be able to just click on a web page to download a TV show unless the site had paid a premium to the telephone company. For the most part, customers would get standard packages of channels chosen by the phone company. In an interview last year, Jonathan Taplin of the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communications said that's a shame.
I don't think that the network operator, whether it's AT&T or Comcast, really should be the one choosing which services flow fast into my home or not.
Taplin, who's produced films for Martin Scorsese and Wim Wenders, said that superfast networks with neutrality regulations to ensure that everything's treated the same could enable a renaissance in film and TV. Viewers would have more choices than ever. Everything from obscure classics on demand to current big-budget series and the works of inspired amateurs in basement studios. Network executives would lose power, viewers would gain it.
And to have that go backwards, back into the old days of where the cable provider was the intermediary between you and the content provider, I think would be a big mistake.
Supporters of net neutrality say Google has a great reason to step up its lobbying on Capitol Hill when Congress reconvenes after the elections and the Senate resumes its debate on neutrality. A new, faster internet without neutrality, they say, would mean that the clips on YouTube stay jerky, blocky, and small, while the telephone and cable companies earn high-definition profits. For On the Media, I'm Rick Carr.
You can watch Rick's piece on the future of the net this Wednesday on most PBS stations. If you want to cry libel, you'd be better heard in England. There, when the media want to name names, they have to confront a strangulating set of legal conditions. So rather than risk being sued, many choose to self-censor. But this week, that iron grip loosened a bit. The pivotal case, Jameel versus Wall Street Journal Europe. It involved an article about how Saudi Arabia, at the request of the U.S., was monitoring the transactions of those suspected of funding terrorism. One business named in the paper sued, and a lower British court, quite typically, ruled in its favor, arguing that the journal hadn't met the Reynolds test, a strict 10-point checklist that's nearly impossible to meet, especially on deadline. But on Wednesday, Britain's highest court decided that judges must also consider if a story was reported responsibly and if it served the public interest. And it reversed the lower court's decision. Neri Shan, a British media lawyer, says it was a giant leap forward for press freedom.
And the way the courts interpreted that defense before was to apply a very rigorous 10-point test, which media defendants had to comply with. And it was virtually impossible. What the court is saying is that the judges should realize that you can still be responsible in publishing a story and not comply with all the things that before the court was saying you had to comply with.
You know, all these years, people who have wanted to sue for libel made an effort to find some grounds in Britain because it was so much more favorable to the plaintiff than in the United States. Now that virtually every publication is in effect global because of the internet, there was a cottage industry in these cases in Britain.
There still is. I mean, this defense is limited to serious journalism or matters of public interest. It doesn't apply to celebrity-type stories, for example. What would change is if the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, were to publish, for example, a story on someone who's alleged to be a terrorist suspect after a rigorous investigation, those articles are far more defendable in the UK than they were before.
I was particularly interested in the remark by Lord Scott of Foscote, who was one of the judges on the panel, and he defended the right of news organizations to publish material deemed private by the government by saying, "It is no part of the duty of the press to cooperate with any government, let alone foreign governments, whether friendly or not, in order to keep from the public information of public interest, the disclosure of which cannot be said to be damaging to national interests."
Yes, one of the criticisms that a lot of people had over the initial judgment by the lower court was that what the judge had said is that because the government had made the decision not to publish names, the newspapers should follow that lead. But I think there's a realization by the House of Lords and more generally that sometimes governments want to keep information from the public for their own self-interest. And it shouldn't be the government that should judge what information should come out to the public and what information should be kept from the public.
It's a very important point, Neri. It also seems like an obvious point that would have come up in dozens of cases over the course of hundreds of years. Why is it being confronted now?
Well, unfortunately, because litigation in the UK is so expensive, it would have taken the Wall Street Journal, the cost of this case going to the House of Lords, what I would have thought be approaching $2 million. So unfortunately, in the UK, we don't have that many cases that go through our courts of this nature.
Do you think people may have a little more courage to bring them to the highest court, even though the cases themselves are just as expensive as they ever were?
I think it will encourage people to publish stories that they wouldn't otherwise have published. And I think it would also encourage publishers to take the risk of taking cases to higher courts, even if they lose at first instance. Hopefully, it will also discourage defendants who bring cases in this country, even though the substantive publication has been in the U.S.
In other words, precisely the case at hand, Jamil versus Wall Street Journal Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the claimant knew that it would have had no chance to succeed in an action in the U.S. because of the liberal laws of freedom of expression you have. So hopefully this case will send a signal to those sort of claimants not to come to our courts in the U.K. But it won't discourage U.S. celebrities, for example, coming to our courts and suing over articles about their private life or matters of tittle-tattle, as we say in the UK.
I'm not thinking of those stories, though. I'm thinking in the US, stories about the archipelago of secret prisons and the tracking of the money of terrorists and Abu Ghraib and all the stories that have originated here that have attracted such harsh criticism. Do you see the two different national media going in two different directions, yours and ours?
I think the way the public are in the UK is that they're very critical of US government policy and UK government policy when it comes to the issues you've described. So the newspapers won't get condemned as being anti-patriotic by publishing those sort of stories. Really, the judgment call that the newspapers have to make in this country is not whether it's treason or anti-patriotic. It's whether they're going to be successfully sued or not. That's the bottom line that they think about.
Neri, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Neri Shan is a UK media lawyer for the firm Taylor Wessing, where he has represented both British and American newspapers.
Coming up, judicial rulings you can hum, and why Jon Stewart may be wrong about The Daily Show.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
You're a Bruce Springsteen fan?
I am, to some degree, yes.
They once asked him, how do you come up with the songs that you write and the characters that are in them? And he said, I have a familiarity with the crushing hand of fate. I want to ask you about the crushing hand of fate in several of your decisions.
That was Democratic Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois questioning Samuel Alito during the Judiciary Committee's Supreme Court nomination hearings back in January. Alito, you may remember, is from New Jersey, and so Durbin Well, I guess you could call it musical profiling. But it turns out Durbin was onto something. Judges, lawyers, legal scholars, they have a particular penchant for dropping musical references into their opinions and journals. And not just any music. Alex Long is an associate professor at the Oklahoma City University School of Law and author of the paper, Insert Lyrics Here, The Uses and Misuses of Popular Music Lyrics in Legal Writing. He found that folk and folk-influenced artists from the 60s and 70s are the most frequently cited. In fact, his top 10 list reads like the tattered vinyl collection of the baby boom. We're so predictable. Take it away, Alex.
Okay. Do you want to do a drum roll or do you just want me to?
Yeah. Go
ahead. Number 10 would be R.E.M. Number 9, Joni Mitchell. Number 8, Simon and Garfunkel. 7, The Grateful Dead. Number 6, The Rolling Stones. 5, Woody Guthrie. 4, Paul Simon. 3, Bruce Springsteen. 2, The Beatles. And number 1, not surprisingly, Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan. If there is such a thing as a rock poet, then it's probably Bob Dylan.
Dylan is largely described as the voice of a generation, and he is the voice of the generation that currently holds a lot of power in the legal profession. And the folk music revival of the early 60s often gets closely linked to the civil rights movement of the early 60s. And if you talk to a lot of older attorneys out there, you come to quickly realize that there were a lot of attorneys and, in fact, a lot of law professors who were inspired by the civil rights movement to become lawyers in the first place. So they've carried those memories and those feelings with them throughout their lives. And there certainly have been good uses of Dylan's lyrics.
Give me an example.
The example I'm thinking of is from a California appellate court that's attempting to explain what the legal standard is for when expert testimony is required. You know, a lot of times when jurors are hearing cases, there are certain concepts that they lack the specific expertise or the knowledge necessary to fully make a decision in this case. Where, however, a matter is just within the common experience of the average person, you don't need an expert. And so in this particular case from California, the court said that in the case of expert testimony, Bob Dylan articulates the appropriate legal role.
Don't you say in your article that this particular citation from Subterranean Homesick Blues is used over and over again for the same reason?
Yeah, well, that's the nature of legal opinion writing. You rely on precedent, and at this point, Bob Dylan has become, or Subterranean Homesick Blues has become precedent in California.
And you note that country music doesn't make the list, and you ask why in the piece, and you say, if one wanted to write about the problems of the working class, the lyrics of country music seem to be more the natural language. The folkies of the 50s and 60s sang about picking a bale of cotton. Johnny Cash actually did it. Pete Seeger was the Harvard-educated son of a renowned musicologist. Hank Williams never finished high school. But those authentic voices don't make the list.
Yeah, I think that country music is normally associated with conservative values. Country music sort of views change as a bad thing. You hear that theme used frequently in country music. And to the extent that country music is Republican or Democrat, it's Republican. Folk music, on the other hand, has always, even though it's supposedly music about common people and about the folks, it's listened to and performed by largely liberal elites, or at least that's historically who listen to folk music. And so law professors, at least, are far more likely to associate with folk music than they are country music for perhaps those reasons.
Tell me what Mader versus Motorola was about.
The issue in this case was just a simple, dull, dry procedural issue. There was nothing particularly interesting about the case itself, and the court made not one but two references to popular music within the space of the same paragraph.
Would you read it?
Sure. The Beatles once sang about the long and winding road, but at the end of the day, the plaintiffs and their counsel were singing the Pink Floyd anthem, Another Brick in the Wall, after constantly banging their collective heads against a popular procedural wall. Northern District of Illinois, Local Rule 12, governing the briefing and submission of summary judgment motions.
The long and winding road that leads to your
Well, it has a beat, but I don't think you can dance to it. Alex, another example that doesn't work appears in United States versus Jackson from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Could you do the honors again and recite the relevant passage?
This was a drug possession case, And in the case, the defendant was sitting on a bus, and eventually law enforcement came onto the bus with a drug-detecting dog and announced to all the riders on the bus that they were free to stay on the bus if they wanted, or they're welcome to leave if they like and get back on the bus once the drug-sniffing dog had completed its duties. As it happened, Mr. Jackson actually had drugs on him. So the court said that Jackson was forced to ask himself what The Clash famously asked 2 decades ago.
Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble. And if I stay, it will be double.
The court said that doubtless Jackson knew that if he stayed on the bus and the dog alerted him, there would be trouble. But given the officer's ultimate discovery of the cocaine strapped to his waist, the trouble turned out to be double, notwithstanding his decision to go.
Someone worked really hard on that one, Alex.
Perhaps too hard. The first part of the quote, I think, is actually pretty clever. The defendant here was presented with a choice. Should he stay or should I go? It actually does a nice job of describing the dilemma that he faced. It's after that that he gets into a little bit of trouble, no pun intended, because the song doesn't actually describe his dilemma at that point. If he had stayed on the bus, presumably the dog would have discovered the cocaine and he would have been arrested. There would have been trouble. But what he did was decide to get up off the bus and leave. And what happened? The dog sniffed the drugs and he was arrested. So even though he left, even though he went, his trouble wasn't really doubled. It was the same trouble as if he had stayed on the bus to begin with.
Now, there is a citation that you talk about that actually works. We mentioned that Bruce Springsteen came in at number 3. And I'm not sure if Senator Durbin used Springsteen all that well in Alito's confirmation hearings. But you mentioned a federal magistrate, Judge Paul W. Grimm, who does. And it involves a Springsteen line that goes, "Is a dream a lie if it don't come true?
Is it something worse that sends me down?"
Yeah, it's from the Springsteen song, The River. The problem that you see with a lot of legal writing that uses these lyrics is the writer will usually preface the quote by saying, "And as Bruce Springsteen once famously remarked." In this case, the judge simply used that line and then juxtaposed it with a quote from an individual who had allegedly been the victim of housing discrimination, who said that the former city commissioner had told the people in the neighborhood to dream about what this neighborhood could be, but he didn't tell us that the dream meant that we wouldn't be included. And all the judge did was simply use that quote and then put Springsteen's quote right next to it. It's just a nice turn of a phrase there.
Did you say finally when you came upon that one?
Somebody got it right, yes.
Alex, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alex Long is an associate professor at the Oklahoma City University School of Law and author of the paper, Insert Lyrics Here, The Uses and Misuses of Popular Music Lyrics in Legal Writing.
Maggie calls Fleetfoot, face full of black soot, talking at the heat, put plants in the bed, but the phone's tapped anyway. Maggie says the men say they must bust an early man.
As we consider the media coverage of election 2006, we might consider the coverage of the election in 2004. That's what Indiana University Assistant Professor Julia Fox and her students did. And after developing criteria that distinguished real information from fluff, she went about quantifying exactly how much hard news was communicated per story in the nightly news broadcasts compared with Comedy Central's Daily Show. What she found was roughly the same level of serious content across the board. But as Adam Ragusea reports, she did find one small difference.
The only difference was that where the Daily Show's information was diluted with humor, network news was equally diluted with hype.
So for people who are worried about, you know, the growing reliance on the Daily Show as a source of news, it's at least as substantive as the source that people have relied on for decades. On the other hand, neither one of them are particularly substantive in an absolute sense. So I think that should give pause to people who are relying on either of those sources.
But Scott Libin, who teaches journalists at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida, is not convinced.
This survey shows the nights of the two national political conventions and the first presidential debate. I think you could argue that those are important milestones in campaign coverage, but not necessarily reflective of coverage overall. They are rich with comedic material, though.
Libin says Dr. Fox's study caught network news at its worst. He also takes issue with Fox's dismissing of poll data, political endorsements, and photo opportunities as mere hype rather than substantive information.
Photo opportunities are, you know, not very substantial, I would have to agree. But hype is usually short for hyperbole, and that tends to mean, what, exaggeration. Well, I don't know that polls and political endorsements quite qualify, and I think polls play a part. I think political endorsements can be significant.
Dr. Fox stands by her methods, pointing out that her study has weathered two complete processes of peer review. Now she's following up with a study that looks at how well viewers absorb information from The Daily Show versus network news. She expects to find that viewers actually retain more information from The Daily Show.
People are laughing. There's a literature on emotional contagion that says people catch other people's laughter. The onset of the laughter when it starts can elicit what we call an orienting response, which is an automatic attentional response. And that can help them process the information that follows. So if there's joke, laughing, and then fact, they may remember that fact better.
But let's move on to the good news. As of last night, North Korea has one less nuclear bomb. Last night at 9:36 Eastern Standard Scary Time, North Korea says it successfully tested a nuclear weapon, triggering the kind of global freakout normally reserved for someone bringing, let's say, 2 ounces of hand sanitizer on a flight to Ottawa.
Dr. Richard Clark is a professor of educational psychology and technology at the University of Southern California, as well as a former television newsman. He says humor can provide the motivation viewers need to really think about what's in front of them.
There isn't a lot of research on this, but what is there suggests that humor makes people more positive emotionally and that it leads them to be motivated to persist and think about things a little bit more deeply sometimes than they would be inclined to. When people are angry or depressed, even if it's only mild anger, mild depression, they're not very motivated to pay attention to things. And I'd say the news presented straight has a tendency to both anger and depress people lately.
What can be done now that North Korea is apparently part of the potentially dangerous club of nuclear nations?
While he acknowledges the power of humor, Dr. Clark is not about to recommend that Brian Williams start cracking jokes on the NBC Nightly News.
Humor is not the only way to motivate people to get involved in stories, and I'm not even sure it's the best way. I wouldn't myself generalize that far. For example, you want people to think deeply about issues, not just because they feel good at the moment, but because they value the issues as part of their responsibility in a democratic society.
But what responsibility does something like The Daily Show really have? No one has more adamantly insisted that The Daily Show is just a comedy show than Jon Stewart himself. With his 2004 appearance on CNN's Crossfire, Stewart made it very clear where he feels the real responsibility lies.
You've got to be kidding me!
You're on CNN. The show that leads into me is puppets making crank phone calls. What is wrong with you?
But whether he likes it or not, Stewart may have transcended his original mandate. If Dr. Fox's findings are to be believed, does that mean The Daily Show should start taking itself more seriously? Fox doesn't think so. She says her research should simply remind people to get their news from a variety of sources, including print media and, of course, public radio. For On the Media, I'm Adam Ragusea.
Once upon a time, there was the television and the audience, separated by the distance from the sofa to the set. To change the channel or the volume, someone needed to physically traverse the living room. But then, 50 years ago, that all changed.
And here it is, the greatest advance in television since color television itself. The ultimate in performance and convenience. 7-function, remote-control color television, so beautiful, it enhances any decor.
Wait a second. Is this about the remote control?
Yeah, I'm doing this.
No, I got it.
Bob, would you just let me do this?
Would you just give...
Bob, give it back.
No, just... I'll do it.
Fine.
It enhances any decor.
But then, 50 years ago... that all changed. In 1956, a Zenith researcher named Dr. Robert Adler created the Space Command, an ultrasonic device that enabled a nation of couch potatoes to switch from Arthur Godfrey and Friends to Father Knows Best without so much as standing up. At the time, it was a novelty. Now it is indispensable. an entertainment master control room in your palm, transmitting via infrared to the television, the cable box, the TiVo, the DVD player, and I'm not sure what all, because I myself can only work like four of the buttons. But without it, you are rudderless and adrift in a 500-channel universe.
So you lose fat, fat.
He addressed his anti-Semitic remarks.
Use in our retirement. Our
it's a poetry club, and I'm actually reading one of my poems. And
can you want without ever having to touch it?
No, on its 50th anniversary, the remote is no mere appliance. It is the bridge of the starship, the scepter, the trident, the magic wand, conferring power on he or she, but let's face it, usually he, who possesses it. Also, without its primacy in the household, what would stand-up comics have to talk about after their hilarious material about getting through airport security is all used up?
Because of the remote control, I now have not watched a complete episode of anything. They give you 50 choices. I have to know what's on every channel. You know, somebody could be having a better time somewhere, and I've got to find it. Where is it?
The comic stylings of Mike McDonald. So ubiquitous is the remote, and so understood is its place in our lives, that it has become a metaphor of control, with one artist after another imagining if its powers were transferable to life beyond the living room. The film Pleasantville and the Adam Sandler comedy classic Click both explored the infrared supernatural.
I'm looking for a universal remote control. Make my life a little easier, less complicated.
Come in the back with me.
About to rock your world.
With the push of a button. No,
the same trope has been employed again and again and again in hundreds of TV commercials from all over the world. Lots of irony there, because the remote is devastating the TV industry, as viewers everywhere zap commercials into oblivion. The commercials, that is, that sponsor all those 500 channels. Dr. Adler, in that sense, is something like Dr. Frankenstein. His creation has returned, 50 years later, to destroy its master.
Oh, it's alive! It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Alicia Rebensdorf and Michael McLaughlin. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from Live from Lincoln Center, presenting Audra McDonald and Friends, featuring Patti LuPone and Nellie McKay on October 12th. Check local listings for times. On Media is also supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.